Elijah was also a Messiah at the time, right? Like he was, didn't he get taken to heaven in the ancient texts, according to them?
He sure did. And Elijah did not taste death, just like Enoch, right?
Right. Now, real quick, I'm sorry, just a side note here. If you read about Enoch, when he gets taken into heaven and basically turned into Metatron, it describes him as becoming this gigantic being. And I had thought to myself, if that is metaphorical for the moon somehow, like the moon itself. I talked to somebody that lives in Tel Aviv several years ago that's strong Jewish background, like, you know, he speaks the language fluently. He's from Tel Aviv. And he said something. What did he say? In a spirit realm or in that type of realm, if you're not talking physical realm, then things could be much larger. But he kind of mocked at my idea. You know, he kind of laughed at my idea of thinking it could be describing the moon in an astrotheological aspect. Now, this is really cool, though. I want to take a moment, and gold recently hit an all-time high and has taken a fresh retreat. So many experts are looking at $2,500 in the near future. Now, I'm not an expert, and there's obviously never any guarantees. But if you look at the information presented, I wanted to share something with you real quick. So, and then we're going to get back to the podcast. Gold prices are predicted to exceed $2,500 an ounce in 2024 with a potential upside of more than 20%. Gold prices are near record highs again. They may keep climbing for the next 10 years. That's what I'm talking about. Read all about it, Barron's. Then silver, hello, is 2024 the year for silver? JP Morgan's silver forecast for 2024, which highlights gold and silver as their top metals for the year and calls for silver to break the $30 mark. Do yourselves a favor. Go to leakprojectgold.com. Get a free ebook, How to Get Out of the Rat Race. Get yourself this free coin that you see behind me. This is a American Virtue 3-ounce silver coin. It will be gifted to you at no additional cost. If you qualify, find out how. 1-877-646-5347. And let's get back to the podcast, shall we?
Well, I can see both concepts there. I don't know about mocking people, but there's a logic to what you're saying. I don't know. I mean, that's whenever you get to you're so good at symbolism and the metaphors that take place. And I always think to find like the story, right? So you're looking at how all these things interweave together, but I'm looking at the story level as to how the story plays out. So I actually, whenever you say something like this, to me, it always fascinates. And like, that's really interesting. Like, I didn't know about Sophia being the mother of, not Elyon. Which one was it?
Yal the Beoth, which is the chief archon, which is the one that, which is Yal the Beoth means ignorant one, actually, if you read the what it means. But there's a lot of similarities, in my opinion, if you read about Yal the Beoth and God referenced in the Old Testament, because isn't there a scripture that God says, I am a jealous God?
Oh, yeah. That's in the rules. That's Exodus 20.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. And actually the story of why he was a jealous God is proved over and over, but like the big story is the flood, right? Yeah. It's like here he goes to all this work to create humanity, all this work to put people on the world, and all of a sudden he has a bad hair day one day, and he just gets somebody does something on planet Earth, which is way far away from heaven, and he gets so upset about it, and he just sends the flood rains down after he has Noah build an ark that will fit his six people. Where all of the Nephilim go? Because, I mean, man, they show up later on, you know, like, so obviously they weren't killed. So anyway, but yeah, so God was upset, and there it says, repenteth me that I have made man, in the King James. Repenteth me. It makes me sick that I have made man. So sorry, and I wish I would have changed my mind. That's what that means. And all through the Old Testament that we have here, and actually most of the stuff at Qumran too, the God, El, the Els, all of them, there was a bunch of them. We should do it. I bet you there's 10. I'll talk to Dr. Davis and find out how many different Els there were.
That'd be great. That'd be great.
I think it'd be really cool because he knows. I mean, he's Dead Sea Scroll translator, right? I mean, holds it up and like sticks it up there and goes, that's amazing. But yeah, I'll find out. You know what? Let me make a note of that. How many else? I don't know. you know,
I'm guessing seven.
It sounds about right, by the way.
Just because 7 days of the week, the seven major, you know, that's just a guess that comes to me, but you could have the seven and then the two that overlook the seven and then the one, which would be basically the creator of the universe. And then everyone.
The demiurge.
Yeah. Anyway, numbers.
That's another story, right?
Yeah.
So a few things here on the map that matter. I just want to give a little info about where the churches were so people can see, like, how did this start, and was it a Roman thing? Well, it really wasn't a Roman thing at the beginning. It was part of the Roman Empire, but had nothing to do with, like, Italy. It had nothing to do with Rome. If you look at just the red, the names in red, like, look over at the right-hand side where it says Syria, and look at the city above that. That's Antioch. That's one of the places that was had an early church. Another one, go straight to 9 o'clock, over to just north of Lycia. It's no 9 o'clock. Like, isn't that 9 o'clock to the left? Yeah, Lycia. And up, go to Asia. Go up by Asia and look for Colossus. No, go to take a right. There you go. And there you are. Perfect. Okay, so here you have several churches. You have Antioch in Pisidia, which is not the same as Antioch down south, of course. It's also a city in Illinois, by the way. Then you can see Colossus, which is the Colossians. That was the letter that was written to those folks. Ephesus is just off to the left. I'll get to Laodicea in a minute because it's not in red. This is where the churches are at this moment, okay? And then if you go over to the purple country over there, that's another part of Greece. That's Corinth there, okay? And then if you go up to Macedonia and to Bulgaria, you see Thessalonica and Philippi. Now, if you ask anybody in the whole wide world, so everybody just get a picture of that in your mind, like that little Greece, Macedonia, Thrace, Asia, that little area right there. Now, can we go back to that very first map we looked at number seven? This is where the Bible, everything else after Jesus dies, happens there. Okay, it's in that Greece, Macedon, Bulgaria, Turkey, this area right here. And when you go there, if you believe in Jesus and the birth of the church, that's the new Holy Land, okay? And it's so weird to think of it that way. But nothing happens in, really not much happens in Rome until about 120 or 130, because all the Christians and all the Jews were expelled, and they were persecuted. Not terrible persecutions. Some people were killed, for sure. But it wasn't as bad as what the movies make it out. I don't know. But nobody was there, for sure. But the letters that we have back and forth between the various governors of these cities and Rome, basically the empire really didn't care about the Christians as long as they said that the emperor is God, that's all we need, and you can let him live. And the guy's cool, I'll do that. And then they did. And almost everybody said, oh yeah, the empire, the ruler of the empire, Hadrian, Trajan, whoever, they're all God. Okay, and that's pretty much what they said. So it wasn't until another 50 or 75 years later that Rome became relevant, all that relevant in the church. People say the Bible was written there, but you saw where the churches were, all the big collections. Sure, maybe they were written in Rome, but why would all the churches be in all these different areas then talking to each other? And when you look at the Gnostic Gospels, you find out your answer, which is that all of these things were written and from different areas all around, basically Turkey, Greece, Bulgaria, Macedon, and Albania, I guess. Albania was a pretty significant area too. Maybe even Kosovo all the way up there. So that's that. And let's go down to, while we're here on churches, I was like, go down to number 11. And let's just take a peek while we're here. Let's just talk about Revelation for a second, okay? Because I know you're big on Revelation, and John, who wrote Revelation, may have been the same John as Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Could have been. I don't lean that way. It's like right in the middle, but maybe. He's on this little island of Patmos, right? And you can see where that is, right in the middle of nowhere. And he's serving out the rest of his life, but like a lot of people, he has a way to get a message out to Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamum. I haven't seen that spelling before. That's interesting. Thyatira? Oh, that's interesting. Sardis, Philadelphia, and Laodicea. And you can see where it is, like the Colossians got their letter there. So in other words, John is writing to all the important places in the world. What does John hate more than anything? John hates what's in the upper left-hand corner. Okay, so when people say, oh, and then the Rome is where the church was. No, Rome is not where the church was. It was where John was looking at. And John wanted to send these messages to this church. For example, Laodicea, he sends out this church that says, you know, you guys are just lukewarm. Basically, in other words, like sliding by, just sliding by, you know, like not taking a stance on anything. John didn't like that. John, part of what makes me believe, and it's believe and not know, that John was legit writer of this book, is that I think this could be a John that actually maybe his dad knew Jesus or his grandfather could have known Jesus. I think those are very reasonable possibilities because he was writing and sending his letter to these churches. Now, all these things have meaning later on in time as well, I believe. This is another belief, not a fact, okay? But I believe they have meaning at different periods of history. But one thing is for sure, Philadelphia there, it's not the same, well, it's the same name as in Pennsylvania, but Philadelphia was, all the good guys were there. Like, oh, you guys are the good people. Everybody else sucks, but you guys are doing a good job, so keep it up, you know? And John had pieces of advice for pretty much everybody, and he gave it to them because he really cared about these people a lot. How it plays out later on in history, a whole different story as to the various, what it could mean today's world or 50 years ago or 1,000 years ago. There's lots of possibilities here. But this is where the books, where his, well, it was sort of a book. It was 20 chapters long, 22. This is where the letters went to, okay? This is where they went to. But you know what they were found? Guess where they were found?
The Dead Sea?
Egypt.
Egypt.
Pretty close, though. So yeah. I love it, though. So anyhow, so you can see that the area that was that where the churches were in about 100 is also where they were when John wrote, which could have been one. I used to think it was around 200 years ago, but I think it's about 100. Also, at the same period, this actually might have been written before the Gospels. It certainly was written before they were ever collected, all four of the canonical Gospels, if you will. But this could have been one of the very first books that was written in this time period that's considered authoritative by the churches. Even though we take books of those authority books out and throw them away, Epistle of Barnabas and Shepherd of Hermas, etc. But nevertheless, this is the big area. So that's that. And I think I have one more slide and I don't recall what I put on it. What's down at number 12?
Do you know if there's any possibility that these locations could line up with certain stars in the, I wonder like why they pick these specific locations. And anyway, do you know anything about that?
You know, I don't know. Okay, so if you want to play for a second, I mean, anytime I see three stars in a straight line, I think of Orion. Okay?
Me too, yeah.
Okay, so I mean, because it's so weird that, like, what are the statistical probabilities, right? It's always low. And there is nowhere else in the sky like that. I mean, it's pretty amazing. So that's the first thing I would play with. The next thing would be, what is triangular? Is not Leo... isn't that the three in a triangle? I could be wrong. I don't think I'm wrong on that.
I think you're right. I'll double check. But yeah, I think that just something off air, maybe I'll spend a little time and see if I can link this up with any
yeah,
of the
relations.
That'd be interesting.
Because, you know, I mean, here's the thing. If your planet is created by a god or God, all right, you might have a sense of humor. You might have interesting puzzles to offer people to live and to have fun with later on and to be fascinated with or to preclude. You know, maybe we need data at a certain time where we have higher technology, where in those days maybe we didn't need the data, but maybe we need the technology now. That map, hypothetically, could be very important. It could mean a lot. And if you include Patmos, all of a sudden, you know, it's even more important.
Oh, so, yeah. Yeah, right? Absolutely. Wow, man. Yeah, I like where you're going with this. Let's see what we got. Let's see. Let me zoom out on that. Oxyrhynchus? How do you pronounce
it? Oxyrhynchus. Right. It was asked. Somebody said, I don't think the Gospels in the chat. I don't think the Gospels were found at Oxyrhynchus or at Nag Hammadi. Well, first of all, most of the Gospels about I think there's seven. No, actually, there's more than that. There's about 60 books. I've listed all of them in 1 through 4. We don't have to go there though, but none of the Gospels, to my knowledge, was found of Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John. None of those four, to my knowledge, was found at Nag Hammadi. But up the street in Oxyrhynchus, which was one of the big finds of all time in history, and literally it's like up the river. I mean, you could be there on the river in probably an hour from Nag Hammadi. And this is where everything was found. I like everything. All of the New Testament is here. I'm not saying this is the earliest fragments that we have of Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Romans, Corinthians, probably Revelation, but I'm not sure. And so it's worth a Wikipedia look sometime to just read about what's been found at Oxyrhynchus. And you'll find that it's not all like stuff about the Bible. A lot of it's just like, I mean, you wouldn't even believe it. Like laundry, there's a laundry fragment that was found. This is what makes it so real to me. Like a laundry fragment was found. Like guy's taking his laundry. Another person needs to have a healing for hemorrhoids. No kidding. It's in the same exact garbage dump from 200 AD. Or some things go back to 100 or even 50 AD, to the time of Jesus. Okay, so Oxyrhynchus, this... You got to read it. I mean, it's like a detective story. Like everything is here. And the thing is, a lot of the stuff that's found in Oxyrhynchus, there's nothing close to it in Nag Hammadi. So there was probably a couple of different cultural variants here, because what was super important in Oxyrhynchus was not super important in Nag Hammadi, and vice versa. So, and by the way, there were also in both of the cities in Oxyrhynchus and also down in Nag Hammadi. I think the Nag Hammadi is a city nowadays and not just an archaeological find. I'm not positive. I think it is. In both areas where they did the digs and they found all these amazing manuscripts, it's amazing what you can find when you go looking. Everything is here from the New Testament and from that period, from that whole period. And when you go through the Oxyrhynchus stuff and you just start like clicking at Wikipedia to find out what's been found, you can learn all about what life was like back in the day of Herod, Jesus, Mary, all the way through the children of that time period and the children of the next time period, to when the war was going on in Judah and being destroyed. It wasn't going on in Egypt. They had other stuff going on. So like, here's life in the time. It was only what do we determine? A few days from Galilee down to Cairo, or maybe we went further south than that. I can't remember what map I drew, but whatever it was, it's not very far. It's a very close thing. Whatever was going on in Egypt was probably happening in Jerusalem at the same time too. So this is worth everybody peeking at later on. All right. I think we're good with the slide.
Okay. I'm just going to show this off real quick. So this, is a list of codices and tractates that have been changed.
Or? No, this is right. So no, this is the, this is a complete list, all these first four slides, of all of the gospel finds at Nag Hammadi, all the things related to Christianity, and possibly even a couple of others that weren't, but I'm not positive about that. But here you can find, like at number 45 there, is a Valentinian exposition. That's actually worth a read, because this is one of the very first churches of Christianity that there was. And I'm not going to go into how they did the Eucharist. You can read about it. It's there. It's not pleasant. But that is a church. It is a church that worships Jesus. And there's a lot of people who would like say, well, you know, the way that your church does, you know, the Eucharist, they made up this word like around 250 or 300 AD. And it's like the way that you had the blood and bread and the water is like, it's, you know, literally letters would go like, what do they call it? What do you call it? Oh, it begins with an A. Come on, help me.
Arguments. Aristocratic insults. I don't know.
when you eat people, what is that called? Cannibalism.
Cannibalism.
Okay. Oh. And so some of these churches were accusing other churches of the time that they were being cannibalistic. So in other words, a lot of people like me are sitting there looking and going, because of Ebionites, they're not going to go, hey, have some wine and bread. Thank you. Okay. And they're not going to go, oh, yeah, that makes sense that that would be Jesus' body. I'm sorry, really? And it becomes Jesus' body when it goes into your body? And it would make sense that somebody would say, that's kind of a cannibalistic point of view there, you know? And it would be argued, oh, people would get hot and angry about stuff like that. And by the way, this is just one example. There's lots and lots of stuff. When you read the Gnostic Gospels, you're never done being surprised. The first time you pointed out the book, the secret book of John, and I had never opened that, and I was mind blown by what I read, you know. But it's like, what's normal to them is strange to us, and what's normal to us is strange to them. So this gives you a list of what's in there, and you can look over on the right hand side and see like what was there. But obviously I shared a few shows ago, a little bit about Philip, a little bit about what else was in here that we quoted from Gospel of Mary, the Gospel of Philip.
Thomas, Gospel of Thomas.
Yeah, Gospel of Thomas. We talked about that too. Oh, look at that. See, Gospel of Philip from the Valentinian collection. So there you go. Mm-hmm. So, but all these things are in the same garbage dump, guys. This whole thing is like this. This like city block of garbage, and it's wild. It's just wild.
It's cool.
Do we have Q's and A's?
We do. Yes, absolutely. The first question is from Patreon, and thank you for being a Patreon, and thank you for the question. It's in reference to the connection of Jesus and the mushroom.
Jesus and the mushroom?
Mm-hmm.
I have nothing.
Okay.
Do I have anything? Have anything on that?
All right. Perfect. That's some people think that there's a connection of Jesus to this specific mushroom out there. I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head, but it looks like a red toadstool kind of, and it's supposed to be like the spirit mushroom.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it is pretty.
No, I have no idea what that could. Wow. Really?
I get schooled every day reading the comments. I'm like, "Oh, cool." You know? So, let's see here. Who came up with the ridiculous concept? This is from Dino, a Patreon. Thank you, Dino. He would like to understand who came up with the ridiculous concept of confession. He spent 13 years in Catholic school dealing with that malarkey. Why would I tell an old man my sins? Hilarious in my book.
That's a cute question that only you have the right answer to. So you take it.
The research that I have done, it has something to do with like intel gathering. So if you go and tell all your sins and then maybe you sinned against the king or you missed something, that might get back to the king, even though you think you're just confessing to your source that's supposed to connect you to God. And anyway, and then here, okay, this is a question I think you would know better than me. Was Jesus' family wealthy, owning a large portion of the land in the area they lived?
This is a great question because there are some scholars that think that his family was very wealthy, and there's reason to believe this. And now, so let me make two arguments. Okay. Let's go with just supporting the question where he's going with it. It's possible because, in Jesus' family, he has a younger sister named Salome. Now Salome, the name Salome, let me back up one more step to talk about wealth. When in the first century, and only the first century, ironically, and this is a weird coincidence, but it is how life was. When you died, you were left in a grave for 1 year if you were wealthy. And then at the end of that year, they took the bones and they put it into the family ossuary, into a tomb. Your body was put into an ossuary, which if you've ever been to the catacombs up in France, in Paris, you see all of the bones stacked and then the skulls are on top. I sat there and I looked at all these guys and I'm like, I'm going to be just like you guys soon. You know, I'll be seeing you soon. I've got photo. I'll bring photos of this gig. It's pretty funny. So, but anyway, when you can't take a body and stick it in a little box, right? In an ossuary. But you can take it after 1 year and then you can, in a sophisticated, elegant fashion, you can put those bones in there and remember Bill. Okay. All right. So here's Bill. He's in an ossuary. The box is about the size of your laptop. Okay. It's about this big. And it fits in there. And we know that Jesus, his ossuary was found in the Talpiot tomb. You can Google it sometime, Talpiot tomb. And the family has their own tomb. The family's ossuaries do not include all of the family, but includes most of it. It includes Jesus, Yeshua. It includes two Marys. It includes a Mariamne, which is the Mary of almost, I've only seen this name three places. I've seen it in King Herod's family line. I've seen it as Mary Magdalene, spelled that way. And I've seen it in Jesus' tomb. Okay? That's what I got. All right? It's really atypical. All right? So now I want to try to show you that Jesus' family was wealthy, but probably not in the way we thought it happened. Oh, by the way, in Jesus' tomb, there is also a the other Mary. There's an ossuary for Mary, and then Joses, J-O-S-E-S. It's not Jesus. It's actually a slang like William and Bill. Okay, it's Bill for William. Okay, because his dad's name was Joseph, right? And then there was, let me think, who else was in there? James. This is really interesting. Wow, I can't believe we're going down this road. Okay, I've never said I was going to go here. So anyway, down the road, about 1 mile or half a mile from the Talpiot tomb, and again, you got to Google it, write it down, Google it, read it. Dr. Tabor is like a legit Dead Sea Scroll scholar, as well as a guy who is always looking for the truth. I have a lot of respect for him. I love the guy. He's brilliant. He found the Talpiot tomb, and he also found the tomb that James was in, his brother. Okay, and that was about a mile down the street. It was not in the same, not in the same tomb. It wasn't in Talpiot, I don't think. But when you're Googling about this, and I think you can Google this and actually get it on Wikipedia, so it'll give you all the details. But anyhow, if you had a tomb like the high priest, Caiaphas had his own tomb. Ananias was in it, and so he got. These people, these family tombs are there only for the really wealthy, the elite, the absolute richest people. I believe, and you can, yeah, there you go. Oh, I might be able to show you something here. Okay, so Talpiot, right, this is the outside. They had to get all kinds of special permissions from Israel and the people who own the apartment complex that this tomb was underneath. See if we can go down and get a look in the tomb, because that was pretty cool. Which one is that? Oh, this is the ossuary of Judah. Okay, right. Let me look at that. Yeah, it's in Hebrew. Okay, so this is the ossuary of Judah. This, you're not going to like this, guys. This is the son of Jesus. That's what it says. Okay, and this is in the tomb. That's what I got for you. Oh, actually, they say it's in Israel Museum now. I bet you. Okay, that's interesting. Okay, so that's all for another story. We'll talk about that a different time. See if we got other photos here. That's where they dug at and sealed later.
This is all we got. I may have to.
Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah.
Okay. So anyway, but there's actually a video. Simone. What's his name? Jahanovich. Oh, blasted! Really smart Jewish guy, scholar. There's a video. If you go to YouTube sometime and you Google or look for James Tabor. Talpiot tomb. It's 2 hours and it documents every single step they take. And a lot of it's boring because a lot of times they got to get approval from the governor. They got to get approval from the prime minister and the people of antiquities, and they're angry and it's very intense. But when they get down there, that they start by sending down, because it's a tomb. It's underneath an apartment complex. How do you like your apartment dug up by some guy who thinks that Jesus' tomb is below your house? No, I don't want that. Okay. So they put down a camera just like you would use like on the moon or something, you know, or down on a, in the ocean, and they look around, and this is where they get their first look, and it's just so cool. People have to go here, and this is like an hour in this documentary before they actually get permission to open it up, you know, as long as they pay for all of the sealing and don't do any damage to the, oh my gosh. So, and how they found it in the first place. This is about 7 miles from Jerusalem, but it's clearly Jesus' family tomb. I mean, statistically, you do the math and all the names match. It's not the entire family, but there was only two people out of the family. Jesus had a huge family, a typical farm family, right? So
was anybody buried in there?
Yeah. There's bodies, there's skeletons in some of them and not in others. But they did a DNA match on the inside of the ossuary. I'm trying to think if Mary Magdalene's was in there or not. I don't recall. I don't think so. I think hers was empty, and I think Jesus was empty. So I'm positive Jesus was empty. So they took DNA from Mary's, and they took DNAs from Jesus. Now, this is a family tomb. The only way that you could be in a family tomb would be to be part of the family, okay? And all of the DNA should match the father, okay? Unless a person was married, okay? So they sent the DNA over, and this was 20 years ago, I think, give or take. So they sent the DNA to Canada, where they knew they could get a fast job done, and they ran it, and the spectral analysis showed these two people weren't the same. So it wasn't a Mary, his sister. It wasn't a Mary, his mother, all right? But it was Mariamne, and it didn't match, but everything else matched. So that's the math, okay? So it's pretty interesting, and for people who are curious and want to find out, I suggest you do that. Now, why is that important to the question that was asked by Dino, I think it was? It matters because if you have a tomb, you're one of 2,200 people in all of Israel ever that had a tomb with ossuaries. There's only 2,200 ossuaries. Among these 2,200 ossuaries in basically the area around Jerusalem, 10-mile radius, okay, that would be about where they are. There's nothing in Galilee like this. So 7 miles south, I want to say, from Jerusalem is Talpiot, and in order to have this tomb, you would have had to have tons of bucks, lots of bucks. It takes up an enormous amount of space, even though it's not huge by the way that we would think of something. It's still the size of this room that I'm in right here, which is pretty big, okay? It's big. And it's got shelves. There's shelves in there where the ossuaries are. The Israel Antiquities Commission has found, like I say, about 2,200 ossuaries in tombs. And to this day, on the black market, if there's no markings on a tomb and it's not found, you can buy an ossuary. There's, you know, some of them are not relevant to history that they care about in any way. They're not cheap, but you can get them. You can't buy one of a legit figure from Jewish history, though. That's not possible. So anyhow, so these things cost a lot of money. It costs money to have them stone cut. You remember that one we had of Judah there, the son of Jesus, sorry. But it was beautiful. I mean, it's a gorgeous piece. So, and that's what these things look like. There's not just like, sometimes there's scratches and names on it. Sometimes you can read and it's Mariamne, but they all have these neat designs that take time. You know, it's like, it takes time and effort. And some of them have little messages. Like I've looked at a bunch of these things that have nothing to do with Jesus or anybody else. And they'll have like a little message like written to the person, you know, sort of like, if you ever go to like, when I visit my mom, you know, she died 30 years ago, 25 years ago. So, but I'll go down and just look at the tombstone, just sort of like a place to be a remembrance. And there's like one phrase there on the tombstone. And that's kind of like what they'll do still down there 2000 years ago for these 2,200 people that were in these ossuaries in maybe probably about 800 different tombs, quite a few. But that's all there is. I mean, after a while, they looked and looked and looked. And this was an accident. The bizarre thing about this whole thing is this whole finding was an accident because, you know what? You guys got to watch the video about this part. I want to go back to the money question. I'm not going to answer for James and his team that he had over there. They're amazing. So money. So was Jesus' family wealthy? So here's what I think. They're born in Nazareth, right? Nazareth has one, I'm going to give you the chance because it has one really substantial house from the first century on the outskirts of Nazareth. It's big, okay? And you don't have any idea who could have lived there. There's no coins. They do date it to the first century, but even that's biased sometimes, like, you know, instead of dating it a century earlier or a century later, you know, just because it's possibly related to Jesus and the Jews, right? The Jews of the day. Okay, so maybe I would give this a 5% chance. Maybe that was Jesus' home. Okay, maybe. Okay, 5%, five, not 95. So in Nazareth, what you find in the first century is a lot of old, just what you would expect in Alabama in 1950 or 1940, just really small places to live. And a lot of people would have lived in there, and no money. There would have been no money in these places. This is the vast majority of what was in Nazareth. That I would give a 92, 5 and 90. I would give another 5% chance to the fact that he was born in Bethlehem, okay? I don't think so. I think he was born in Nazareth. In fact, I'm almost positive. And we'll talk about that. If we do a Christmas show, we'll talk about that. Because it's a beautiful story. It's where I get to not be Mr. Scholar and beat up on things. I really love the Christmas story. The way I think it really played out is just gorgeous. And but anyway, so here's this poor dude, right? Born to Joseph, you know, and he's an older guy. He's probably about 60 years old. He marries a very young girl. They go and they have all these kids. And did he have money? I doubt it. There's all kinds of evidence that shows, in fact, the Secret Infancy Gospel of James. The Secret Infancy Gospel of James, which we will talk about at the Christmas show, is it basically says that Joseph was one of the sub-priests at the temple, not one of the big guys, but one of the little guys. And there were, every now and then, kids would get dropped off at the temple because, sort of like in the old days, 100 years ago, they'd take a kid to the fire department because they couldn't raise the kid on their own. Okay, Depression era, about 100 years ago. So, actually, that didn't happen. 75 years ago. So, but anyway, same kind of concept. So they would take it, and the story there, without going into the whole Christmas thing, is basically mom and dad, they're pretty well known, but they can't take care of the little girl, and she's lost to the whichever priest. They all have to roll dice, sticks. Basically, it's sticks in those days. But just think dice or dragon dice. You know, they roll the dice. Everybody rolls the dice. Joseph loses, and he has to take home Mary. He doesn't want to take her. He's really not in a good mood this day. It's like, no. Like, I've worked my whole life, and now I have to take home a 12-year-old wife? Wow. The story is in the Secret Infancy Gospel of James. Okay, and it's the whole story. So there's no like room for debate. It's either that or make up something on your own. Okay, because those are the two stories of how Joseph and Mary got together. That's it. That's the one story. There is no other story. None. This is it. It either happened or it didn't. As I read through it and as I look back at temple culture back in the day, it makes total logical sense. There are a few miracles in this gospel, as there are in all. There's always something strange in each of these gospels. Like, you know, like when Jesus, in the book of John, in the book of John, when Jesus is resurrected, not resurrected, when he's crucified, he cries out, Eli, Eli, sabachthani. And then all of a sudden, there's tombs all around Jerusalem. There's bodies that come up, zombies, literally. They come up of people who are really good people that were Jews. And they're all resurrected and they walk around the city. That's what it says. But nobody remembers that part. That's in John, in your Bible, like right now, like it's in the Bible.
That's okay. Where they came up with Walking Dead.
I didn't even think of that.
I knew it. It's going to be a hit. Great. It's right out of the Bible. Zombies.
And nobody, I mean, seriously, I've told this story to like 25 people. And people are like, that didn't happen in the Bible. And I'm like, right there, the curtain is torn. Jesus says, Eli, Eli, sabachthani. And what happens next? Tombs from all around the city are opened up of good people. It says good people. What's the word in English? It would be like good people. I don't know what the
non-sinners, those that repented and paid their tithings.
Right, something like that. I mean, just basically the good-hearted people of Galilee, you know. So, but except for it was in Jerusalem, so it couldn't have been all that big. But anyway, so that's the story, though. It's a pretty cool story. So Jesus then himself probably has no money, yet he's found, his tomb is found, the family tomb is found, and it's big. It takes care of the family people. And so how do they get the money? So there's two little pieces to the puzzle then. So now I have to like be a storyteller and not a scientist looking down on it. Now I'm a storyteller. I have to figure it out. So there's 2,200 ossuaries. So what do? I go and I look up every single ossuary. All right. This is how serious I take this book. All right. On the Unholy Trinity book. It's like, I really want it to be right. And so first thing I do is I check and I'm looking for people's names and I'm looking for only one name really. I mean, I look for Mariamne. Okay, I think I found one. And then there's a bunch of Marys, by the way, like 70. I think I found about 70. And then I found about 25 or 30 Salomes. Okay, now, that's interesting. All right, normally I would never talk about this publicly because I'm not an expert on this and I'm so fascinated with it. It's like almost like it's so exciting to me. But so there's a Salome in this tomb, okay? There's Salomes that Josephus writes about, and they're all in King Herod's family, okay? All right, that's that. Tomb, family, there's 30 tombs that have a Salome in it, that have an ossuary with her name on it. That's a lot. That's a bunch. Huh? Statistically likely, right? Well, but try to find her name in other Jewish literature, all right? It's like, it's not there. Like, why isn't it there? It's in Herod, it's in his tomb, it's in the Bible. Okay, so that's interesting. And there's other puzzles that we can use to piece together the families, especially one where Herod has a stepdaughter, for example. Well, why would he have a stepdaughter? It gets long and complex. But here's the deal. I think that Herod knew Herod's family and the family from Migdal, Mary's family. I think they were connected, and we certainly know they were connected to Jesus. There's no doubt. This is a 100, because Herod's manager, if you will, his manager of all of his affairs, is Chuza, C-H-U-Z-A. You can look him up in the Bible. He's right there. You can look his wife's name up. It's Joanna. They were married to each other, lived with Herod, took care of all of his everything. They took care of all his business, right? And they did apparently forever. This woman, Joanna, is now a saint in the Catholic Church. Okay, that's how important she was to the Catholics. The Chuza is mentioned in the earliest gospel, which is Marcion's. Okay, that's pretty amazing. That's actually stunning to me. And because that's 140, that shows this is not a tradition like that they made up 200 years later. So even though nobody ever reads about this, Joanna follows Jesus. Think about this for just a second. Do this. Joanna is a follower of Jesus because she's a sponsor of Jesus, just like Susanna. There's a woman named Susanna and Mary Magdalene, right? We know of at least these three by name. There's several others. Jesus was followed by many women, and women were married in those days. You got married, and you usually got married very early. 12, 14, 16, 18 is pretty norm. If you didn't get married by 18, you better not have a baby because you're going to die, literally. Like, you're going to get stoned to death, okay? So there's problems to be had. So anyhow, so let's put this back together now. So we have Chuza, who, by the way, in Marcion's gospel, I believe, I could be making this part up, but I believe he's a shipsman as well. So I could be wrong on that. So, but check it. But nevertheless, so we have Joanna, Susanna, Mary Magdalene, several other women that follow Jesus. They're always mentioned. They're mentioned as often as the disciples are. Now, Joanna and Chuza, husband and wife, they're Herod. They're Herod's like family. They work for him. They live with him. They take care of his affairs. All right. Herod was incredibly wealthy. King Herod had more money than you could even know what to do with. So now you got a king with Chuza and Joanna, who are now, Joanna's now hanging out and sponsoring Jesus. And Mary Magdalene comes from Migdal. Migdal is halfway between Capernaum and Tiberias. There is every reason from the word Magdalene and Migdal, they both mean the same thing, which is tower. Peter was a rock and contrasted with the tower. Okay? So when Jesus was playing with words one day, as he did all the time, literally, it's like, Peter, you are my Petros, my little stone, my little rock, right? And we have a tower over here, Mary the Tower. So it's ironic, maybe, maybe not, that Magdal, Migdal, and Magdalene have the same meaning. Okay, sort of like Sophia would be wisdom, and it would also be apparently right the goddess who the goddess who gave birth to
what basically the mother of the Demiurge.
Oh, geez, really?
She's the mother of the Demiurge, 100%. Yeah. Hello, bring a pen and paper.
All right, I'll look. So now, does Jesus have money? So Jesus gets money when he goes into his ministry, all right? We know this part, but he needed sponsors, okay? He had to have these women as sponsors. So he did not have enough money from his life. And he was a traveled man. He's not stupid. There's times where you can clearly tell he's also not the brightest, most brilliant person, but you can tell his character. Okay, he's a lot like a lot like normal everyday people. He's edgy. He fights with his family, and I think he has a normal Nazareth childhood upbringing, but he got lucky. And I think that he was sent to Egypt probably by his dad or his mom or both. And I think he actually did duty at schools with probably Philo, and certainly I'm sure he must have gone to Alexandria, the Heliopolis, places like that, and learned down there, which would have made him very schooled as far as Egypt, but it wouldn't have done a whole lot. You know, I mean, yes, there were Hebrew there were Jewish temples at the time in Egypt, for sure, but the chances that he actually got to a Jewish temple are small if he's being schooled by Egyptians, unless he's staying with Philo, which I certainly doubt, but it's possible. It's possible. So anyhow, so the most likely scenario, the way that I write a story, is that he comes into money when he starts his ministry, and his money had to be gotten by somebody who was well connected already to him and to money. Okay, which means they had to be government or they had to be landowners. Right, that's pretty much all there is. So the likely connection is that Salome, there's a connection here, and we have the Chusa Joanna connection. And I think if I had to bet, I would bet about 40 or 50% that Salome are the same person who dies asking for John the Baptist's head in the Bible. This is not how John is seen as dying, by the way, in Josephus. I trust Josephus' account more than I trust the Bible account. It makes more sense. It's more logical. It doesn't have a point to it. And Josephus loved John the Baptist, and he wrote a lot about him. So that's pretty cool. But nevertheless, the point, though, that's good there, by the way, is that the connection is made between Josephus, an Essene, a scholar, but working for the Roman Empire. And he's got John the Baptist dying in this way, but later the Bible is actually written about 110 AD, 120, and this part of the Bible. And so now it's like this story comes up 20 years later, but they make the story about Salome and the dance and all that kind of stuff possible. Anything's possible. And the two stories could be merged together, but it's just, I think that's just asking for a lot. So anyhow, so the point is that Jesus had a couple of connections. One was with his sister to Herod. I think that's better than a 50-50 shot. And, for sure, 100 that choose. I mean, you don't mention a guy's name Chusa as working here, and his wife is out there with Jesus, and nobody ever goes, but how is that possible? Because Herod must have tried to kill Jesus, you know, like in 4 BC. But remember, this is his grandson, right? Herod was alive when Jesus, Herod died right before Jesus was 2 years old, okay? Herod dies then, and then his son and then his grandson take over, right? And so this is his grandson that would have been connected with Salome. I'm not saying that's a for sure. I'm saying for sure that Chusa and Joanna were married, and that because that's what it says, and that's a ridiculous detail. Whenever you look at the Bible, if something like, why would you put that in there? Like, it makes no sense to like have that in there. Is it really that important? If somebody wrote it down and they didn't pull it out to throw it away, then it really happened and enough people knew about it. Okay, that's the whole deal. Enough people already knew they couldn't pull it out and change history. So, and remember, I told you in the Codex in the Bible from 350, 375 AD, that Codex had 30,000 changes. 30,000. You can read it on Wikipedia, and it gives you some of the big ones and the better ones. There's like a list of 25 or 50 of them there, and it'll tell you like Matthew 4, and I mean, it gives you the whole list of some of the cool changes that were made. Cool meaning, wow, can they really do that? Wow, can they really do that? Wow, why did they do that? Wow, oh my gosh. And people wonder why we all believe something different, right? So anyhow, so the answer is I think Jesus came into money when he was about 27 years old. I think it came via Joanna and via Mary Magdalene. And I think it's because he probably connected with Mary Magdalene as a special companion, which in those days was called the same thing as a wife, okay? There were no weddings except for among the wealthy. And by the way, Jesus did, his mom presided at a wedding in the city of Cana, his mom from Nazareth.
Cana? Where?
In Cana. Go ahead, put it up on Wikipedia. Wedding Cana. Cana wedding. It's one of those things that's puzzled people in religion forever, but it's really not that complicated. C-A-N-A wedding.
It's pulling up. Let's see what we got here.
That's it. So check it out, right?
Whoa.
So for you guys in the car, it says the wedding at Cana, also called the marriage at Cana, wedding feast at Cana, or marriage feast at Cana, is the name of the story of in the Gospel of John, at which the first miracle attributed to Jesus takes place. Jesus, his mother, and his disciples are invited out to a wedding at Cana in Galilee. But and then I'll skip and I'll just tell you the rest of the story because I don't want to read the whole damn thing. Basically, okay. What happened is Mary says, go do this, go do that, you know, get stuff done. Only the mother of the groom does that, right? Like, and so it does, like, ask you, like, this is the one story that we have of Mary in the New Testament, really, that is just about her, okay? It's about her actions, and I'm talking New Testament as a Gospel of John, okay? So, because it's not mentioned in this other synoptics. So that's pretty cool, and so it probably was Jesus' wedding, but more important is that during his ministry at the very beginning, he had money, or he would not have been invited, but his mom probably was part of that thing, and so they already had money at that point. But it also could have been for other reasons. Maybe he was also, by the way, connected to the Herodian family and didn't find out till later. There's other explanations I've come up with, but the most likely is that they were connected by interfamily marrying, which was common for a girl who would have been like a princess from a royal family. And if the second Herod down really believed that this was like the sister of a son of God, or not the son of God, but a guy who's going to be the Messiah, the king someday, or a high priest, he'd take her. He'd go for that. Sure. How much do you need? You want what? I loaned some money to a friend of mine recently so he could pay for his wife. So he could, a dowry is still a common thing to this day. It was in those days. That's another common explanation for me as to how this could all happen. So the answer is ultimately yes, but it took a while to get to wealth.
Okay. Yeah. Right. Great answer, man.
Too hard on that.
They need to upgrade their Patreon on that answer. So folks, thank you for that. Much appreciated. And it added a lot of, you incorporated a lot of other stuff also. So I applaud you for that. And then I'm just going to show you here. So what I did was I put on YouTube and on Patreon that you're going to be a guest and I was going to ask you questions. So any questions, feel free to ask. I don't know if we're going to get all of them today, but did want to get to maybe a couple more here. And this was the one I asked you about the mushroom. And we're not sure of that. So we'll get news of 11. And then this is a good question, though. Did the Old Testament happen before the New Testament? You've talked about bits and pieces of this, but maybe you could give a summed up answer. Yeah, that's possible.
Well, you never know. Summed up answer would be most of it. Because the book of Daniel was still being written present tense when Jesus was alive. And most people think that it was finished in 165 BC. We can prove that that's not the case, though, with paleography. Most people don't know that. The book of Enoch most people would consider a New Testament book because it's apocalyptic and prophetic and sort of matches very well with Revelation and with Matthew 24. Okay, so that would be, even though it was written 350 years earlier than Jesus' life really wasn't the New Testament, Old Testament thing. It was really more about the time periods, right? So Enoch was written 350 BC originally. That would be, but it wasn't included in the Old Testament by the Greeks or the Hebrews, the Jews at the time. So there's that. So the answer is most of the New Testament is found in Egypt. All of the Old Testament, except for the Book of Esther, is found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And those two things are definitely separated, but there's overlap. There is overlap. They were still writing. Jubilees was being rewritten about 50 AD after Jesus and before the war. Jubilees was being rewritten. It had been written 250 years before, but it was being rewritten during Jesus' life. And it's a big book. And by the way, if you ever want to know like the best story about Genesis, read Jubilees. It's amazing. It's so clear, and it's a beautiful book. It's fascinating. It'll blow your mind away. And it explains all of the things that make no sense in Genesis. It takes you through the sons of God, the Watchers, and the Nephilim. And it takes you through Enoch, and it takes you through Abraham and all the stuff that he went through with his beautiful wife. And oh, God, that whole story. And having sex with Rebecca. And all it was complicated. So, but anyhow, it's all in Jubilees, and Jubilees does a great job. And by the way, Jubilee comes from the time calendar, 50 years, which, by the way, was 49. And the other day you mentioned 360 was before 365. Same thing was true at Qumran, by the way. They figured out 360 before they figured out 365.
Cool. Okay.
Well, I hope that answers the question. Mostly yes is the answer.
Thank you. Absolutely. And Susan would like to know, first of all, Susan, this first question, go back and watch a few of our podcasts we did prior, because this is explained in wonderful detail. She asks, who is Jesus, his real title in history? That takes for 4 hours plus. Go back and watch those because it's totally described. But she asked two questions. So what are your thoughts on the Trinity? She says, is the Trinity even real?
Jesus was the Messiah, anointed one, right? So he was going to be the king of Israel. And he was destined for that based on lineage. And he grew up with that feeling of being responsible to do that. The second half of the question was?
Is the Trinity real?
You're in public, Kev. So that's, first of all, it's a really important question. All right. So let's start off with the argument for the Trinity. Okay. The argument for the Trinity would be that there are three. There is the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Okay. Ghost is a word that King James boys came up with. That wasn't like real. Okay. But spirit is still pneuma, right? You know that Greek word is pneuma. And the idea that pneuma would be a person was improbable. Okay. Improbable. But if you look in some Bibles, like the King James Bible, for example, that's the first Bible that we all had when all this started in for 350 years. So you look in the King James Bible, John, 1 John 5:7. 1 John chapter 7, verses 8 and 9, I think it is, 1789, yeah, you got to have these little memory tools sometimes. So it says, yeah, that this is there. Okay, so I had this proof texted to me one day. Somebody's having a discussion with me, and I'm like answering this question. And they said, yeah, but look right here. And I said, actually, that's not a Bible. Okay, so the person has their Bible. It says Holy Bible on the side, but it's not the Bible. Okay. It's a really interesting, fun to read book that was written long after the Bible scripts at Qumran and in Egypt, which contain things like Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Thomas, Gospel of Philip, Thomas, all this stuff. There's no Trinity mentioned anywhere else in any of the other Gospels. There are certainly connections to spirit as being really important. Okay, so the idea, and then I'm gonna have you So the answer, the first part of the answer is to support it is it, that it's in the King James Bible, and it's pretty crystal clear on how it's written, almost as if it was written to prove this point. Okay, so I promise you that's why it was put in there, but it was not in the earlier manuscripts, and it's really super easy to check that out. By the way, everything I say can always be fact-checked. All you have to do is just go online, go early manuscripts of John or any other book that I talk about, that we're chatting about, and you can just get the digitized version. Everything is digitized. It's all there. So you can look, and you can literally, and you're like, Kev, I don't read Greek. You don't need to be a Greek scholar. You're looking for specific words like pneuma and how it's used, for example. And it's really easy to learn these letters, super easy. So you can tell. So anyhow, this wasn't in the early manuscripts. And the very first manuscripts we have that had this were about 300 years after Jesus died. Okay, so so there's that part. On the other side, we have how those people of that period, how the people of Jesus' life period looked at gods. Jewish culture was based, it was now steeped in Roman culture, right? And so you had several hundred beings who had been born of a virgin, lived a life, went to heaven, ascended right in front of your very eyes, okay? So that's a really common thing. So Jesus never said that he was God, ever. That wasn't his deal. So you have these three parts of the thing. Holy, the word holy, as it's said in the New Testament, is almost like it is the Old Testament, very similar. Ruach is the Old Testament word. I'm sorry, man, you asked. So Ruach is the Old Testament word. Pneuma is the New Testament word. They do mean the exact same thing. He breathed on her. And this is something they did in those days, by the way. It was like shaking hands. They breathed spirit, like your essence, who you are. It was a very important concept, but it wasn't a person. And the same thing is that Jesus, people would say like, oh, so you think you're something special, like you're the Son of God? Jesus never said that. No. Jesus was just exactly like Enoch. Specifically, there's only three places all of this is mentioned: the Bible, Enoch, and the Dead Sea Scrolls. Son of man, okay? Enoch was the Son of Man, Jesus was the Son of Man, and in the Dead Sea Scrolls, they were waiting for the Son of Man, okay? So there, that's what he was. He was very special. He knew he was special. He knew he was unique, but he never would have said he was the Son of God. First of all, it's insulting, okay? Because a Son of God would make you somebody who would have sex with a woman and create a Nephilim, okay? All right? You with me? All right? So it's sort of an insulting thing that he would be called the Son of God. So the idea that he would be thus a demigod, if you will, like the archons. Well, no, like an archon, I guess. So, like, yeah, you could make him into a creator, sure, you could. But that'd be like calling you a god, you know, and say, oh, you're such a god. Well, how about legend? Legend works. You know, it's like I could, you know, don't call me a god, because that's, you can't live up to that. So Jesus called, he never said what he was. People always said, they say that you're the Son of Man, or they say that you're Elijah, come back. And they had all these things, but he never said he was the Son of God or God. He never even implied it, okay? The book of John, which was written closer to 250 AD or 200 AD, could have been the same guy that was at Patmos, by the way. I sometimes think so. John has a very religious, eschatological point of view. In the beginning was the Word was with God, the Word was God, and blah, blah, blah. All the things that were made through him. Okay, so we all get that. But the early Gospels, the ones that were written first, Matthew, Mark, Luke, there's nothing like that in there. There's nothing. The word logos is something that comes from Greek, and Philo used it quite a bit down in Egypt, but nobody in Israel did. So if I had to put all of my money out on there, I would say the answer is no. There's no reason to have a Trinity. It was added, I believe, and you can fact check this at Wikipedia, but I believe it was added in 500 AD, about 200 years after Nicaea. Okay. It's not in the Nicene Creed. I don't think. You never know, because things change in the church writings all the time, but I'm betting it wasn't. And I think it was about 500 AD that it was added.
Okay. Thank you for that. That sounds like the, that's very literal. And that's excellent, because I think that's the question she was asking and you answered it the way. Now, what I started thinking of is the Trinity. You can take that back pre-Egypt and you can actually look at the mystery schools and they change the Holy Spirit with something else. You know, what does it take to make a child, a father, and what else?
There's, you know, a father, a son, and right. Oh.
You know, so, and I wanted to point out something else also, which is really, really cool. And this makes me think of the Trinity in symbology. Hey. So many of the structures, megalithic structures, will have three doors. The largest will be in the center and they'll have two on each side. And this to me is symbolic as like the Holy Trinity or the Trinity. And even the number three itself, 369, Tesla's connections with 369. 369 is three numbers. And you're obviously taking the threes in. I think it's a very deep meaning. So when I see this, when I read these things, I'm like, oh, okay, they're connecting it to an ancient art. They're connecting it to an ancient magic or an ancient type of hermetics. So many of these scriptures are written in code, and then they're translated in code. I have a lot of friends that are Freemasons. I'm not a Freemason, but I've got friends that are, and I've got ancestors that are, and I can see a very similar codex in these translations.
Yeah,
and,
for sure.
Yeah, yeah. So I just thought that was the thing that came to my mind.
Daniel in Revelation, and this is one of the reasons that Daniel didn't get done being written for 200 years. It was constantly being updated because it was like the ultimate apocalyptic book before Revelation, like 200 years before Revelation. So yeah, so what you're saying is really important because people need to know, like, updated is the real key word here. Like, things do get updated and they change. And in history, there's cycles like, and I think in terms of cycles, you think in terms of symbology matching, they're sort of similar. I see things as repeating, as almost, not exactly, the car wasn't invented 100 years ago, but a form of transportation might be, or that we went somewhere or did something. I see some of this stuff in history, like you see attachments between literal and metaphor, you know, which is pretty cool, which, by the way, is how we all, there's only two ways a human being can learn, and one is imitation and the other is through metaphor. That's it. I mean, that's what we got. So there's no reason to believe otherwise.
Right on. Well, okay. So one more awesome question from the chat. And this is a great question. Your thought on the Holy Grail and the Jesus bloodline connection?
This is more appropriate to a crucifixion episode. It's a couple hours.
Stay tuned for the next episode. Should I say that?
There's a stone underneath the throne. Yeah, I'll give a future's foresight. There's a stone underneath the throne of the King of England right now.
Okay.
And it's like 2,000 years old. And it's an interesting story how it might have got there. So stay tuned.
Cool. All right. That's what I'm talking about. Well, Kevin, thank you so much for sending some books out to my parents. They're huge fans. They actually took a photo. They've got them all like up on the desk. Super stoked. You're awesome, dude. Thank you so much for that. That made my day.
Thank you. And great questions, by the way. Keep them coming.
I will. And when the garage is a little bit warmer, I'm going to wear my Metatron cube shirt that you sent me. Right. It's just like, people are like, Rex, why do you keep wearing? I'm in the garage. It's kind of cold in here, man. You obviously can't tell with the, okay, I'm really not in the garage. I'm in the Vatican archives, as you can see behind me here. I'm just glitching out. But yeah, it's kind of cold in here. So I'll wear that shirt next time with the space heater in the garage.
I love it, but don't do it for me, Jess.
It's a kick-ass shirt, man. That's the guy of all the shirts. I'm like, dude, this guy read my freaking mind, man. How does he do that? Oh, wait.
Like, what would you identify most with, right? And it's like, I was like, oh, Enoch, Metatron. There you go. That's the deal.
Nice. Yeah. Nice. Well, any words of wisdom, anything else you want to share this before we finish this up? And thank you again.
Yeah, if there's question, we can take any question you want. So we're open. There's a lot of stuff I don't know about. Jesus and mushrooms, I'm ignorant. Just like everybody else, I have areas where I'm good at and other areas where other people know way more than I do.
Thank you. Absolutely. I'm going to show off your website real quick and subscribe to Kevin's YouTube channel. I'm subscribed. I've hit the bell for all the notifications. Great podcasts. You know, one of the things I really like about you, Kevin, is not only are you pretty smart, but I like how you listen and you ask, you know, you just seem very genuine, and it's hard to find genuine people anymore. So thank you for that, man.
My grandma and my mom's fault. I got nothing. Thank you.
Right on. All right, everybody. Have a beautiful day. Hit the bell. Be well. And be the change you want to see.
Real quick, check us out over on Patreon. Why? Because I have hundreds of hours of exclusive content, ad-free, uncensored, unedited, stuff that we can only talk about on Patreon. Beyond the cutting edge. And you'll get access to it. We're only $1 a month. And if there's an interview that you want me to do, a guest that you want me to get on the show, or a topic that you want me to discuss, if you leave a comment over on Patreon, I'll do my best to get that guest on the podcast or that subject. And I'll even do my best to get back to you here on YouTube. And your contributions greatly help Leak Project. So check us out over on Patreon, and please subscribe to our YouTube channel here and hit the bell for all notifications, and check back daily for new podcasts, because we upload podcasts pretty much every single day. And has anyone told you today that you're awesome? Because you are.